Well, good evening. Welcome back once again to One Step Beyond. I'm going to give you a summary of what's in tonight's broadcast. You know things are getting bad when the theme for a political talk show is taken from an editorial cartoon. Well, that's exactly what I'm going to do this evening. In the Los Angeles Times of Wednesday, August 15th of 1990, this past Wednesday, there is a political cartoon by their brilliant and incisive political cartoonist Conrad, and it shows Saddam Hussein with the beret on and so forth, and he's talking on the telephone, and he's got a big smile on his face, appears to be laughing, and he says, "Hell, George, you should be thanking me. Nobody's mentioned SNL's recession or the budget for days." One more time, that's the theme for tonight's show, in a sense, taken directly from a political cartoon, which I think, if this is humorous, obviously it's meant to be. I think it exemplifies Nietzsche's phrase that a joke is the epigram on the death of a feeling. One more time, from the LA Times editorial cartoon, Wednesday, August 15th of 1990, on page B7, Conrad captions a picture of Saddam Hussein laughing and talking on the phone. "Hell, George, you should be thanking me. Nobody's mentioned SNL's recession or the budget for days." And that basically is the theme we're going to be talking about this evening. Why are we in Iraq? What can we reasonably expect from our involvement in Iraq? And beyond that, we're going to begin, in a sense, where we left off last week. We're going to begin by talking about some of the hidden history of the Vietnam War. The U.S. move into the Middle East is our biggest military operation since the Vietnam War, and we're going to be taking a look at some of the less well-known but more important and very depressing, frankly, aspects of the beginning of that very tragic war. Last week we spoke about how the assassination of President Kennedy helped to involve us in Vietnam. We're going to begin, in a sense, where we left off last week with the Kennedy assassination. We're going to listen to the trial transcript of the Colonel Fink, the surgeon who performed the second autopsy on President Kennedy's body. And in the trial, in his testimony before Jim Garrison's court in New Orleans, he actually testified that he was ordered by his superior officers, unnamed admirals and generals, not to dissect the neck wound. We'll talk about that, but by way of examining the present in terms of the past, also by way of showing just how important it is for people to get off the grassy knoll. Last week we spoke about this Roscoe White story, which who knows whether Roscoe White was in fact involved with some aspect of the assassination. It wouldn't surprise me, but I doubt very seriously that he was a gunman, and I'm incredibly suspicious about the communiques he is alleged to have received ordering him to perform the assassination. Those things just aren't communicated in those sorts of open, verifiable channels, and I doubt very seriously that those communiques are straightforward. I suspect this whole thing is a cutout. Who's floating this cutout and why they're doing it at this time is anybody's guess. But anyway, I talked about that last week. We also spoke about that in a phone conversation with Marlena Smith and Lanny Simkin of the Christic Institute, who broke the information to me. The discussion last week of the Kennedy assassination of the Vietnam War is going in as a supplement to the Guns of November Part 3. My talk with Lanny Simkin and Marlena Smith is added both as a supplement to the talk, the Dan Sheehan, Sarah Nelson talk that I had on July 8th, and also as a supplement to the December Surprise 89, because they had some fascinating ruminations concerning the assassination of Judge Vance, and also the shooting at another judge on the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. This just as the oral arguments for the Christic Institute's suit were being heard on appeal before the 11th Circuit Court. And again, we'll touch back on a U.S. invasion of Panama by way of examining some of the funky ways our military gets themselves involved in foreign wars, and we'll be looking at that this evening. We're going to begin by listening, as I said, to a tape from Radio Free America, a section of Radio Free America number 12. We're actually going to listen to some of the trial transcript from Jim Garrison's investigation, his trial of Clay Shaw. And we're actually going to hear Colonel Fink testify that he was ordered not to dissect the neck wound. People tend to forget this as they evaluate the material concerning President Kennedy's assassination, that in an American law court, and the Warren Report, or the Warren Commission rather, was a presidential fact-finding commission, had no legal status whatsoever. It was part of the executive branch of government, not the judicial at all. Well, that in the only time the Kennedy assassination has ever come to court, There was absolutely irrefutable evidence of a conspiracy, as if any intelligent person really needed that evidence once they've examined the basic facts. The official version is not just wrong, but totally impossible in most of its major manifestations. We touched on that last week. We'll talk about that again later. But after hearing the trial transcript from Jim Garrison's trial of Clay Shaw down in New Orleans, in which Colonel Fink testifies that he was ordered not to dissect the neck wound, we're going to begin examining the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And that basically was the incident which resulted in the passage of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution and our entire sad, tragic involvement in Vietnam. We're going to begin with an article from the San Jose Metro from August of 1989, just talking about a fellow who's a Hoover Institute fellow, a guy named James Bond Stockdale. Vice Admiral Stockdale was a pilot, a carrier pilot, and was involved in some of the air action attended on the Gulf of Tonkin incident, and was later shot down over Vietnam and was held prisoner of war. He's going to talk about the fraudulent aspects under which we got involved in the Vietnam War. This by way of supplementing the information last week from Colonel Prouty, plus National Security Action Memoranda 263 and 273. We're then going to take a look at a very important hidden chapter in not only the Vietnam War, but the Gulf of Tonkin incident in particular. We're going to take a look at the raid on Han Mae Island, a raid conducted by some Navy SEALs, some Navy commandos, and according to the information presented here, it appears as if this was part of the Gulf of Tonkin operation and basically was a deliberate attempt at provoking hostilities in order to fingerprint North Vietnamese radar installations. We'll talk about that as the third item up in our program. Then I'm going to run through very quickly. I'm not going to read at any length, but I'm going to run through a number of items that have appeared in the various daily papers concerning the U.S. move into the Middle East, the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. I don't pretend to have all of the answers concerning the U.S. move into the Middle East, but we're going to ask some of the questions and kick around a few of the possible answers as we examine various articles. We're going to touch very briefly on a column from the San Francisco Examiner that we read last week, this by Examiner columnist, Stephanie Salter. We're going to take a look at an article column on how Kuwait got bad advice from the United States, indicating the possibility that U.S. naval maneuvers vis-a-vis Kuwait helped to trigger the current crisis. Exactly whether that was deliberate or not is anybody's guess. We will be offering up a few of those guesses. We're also going to take a look at, very briefly, we're going to review some of the ways in which the United States has helped Iraq in the past and ruminate about the possible role of American support of Iraq in the past in the current situation. It's interesting to read some of the columns and articles that are coming out pursuant to the U.S. move in the Middle East because it's fascinating how many mainstream columnists and journalists are floating, quote, conspiracy theories, quote, unquote, with regard to the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait and the U.S. move in there. Anyone who's listened to this program for some time knows how much I hate the term conspiracy theorist. I think it's basically an insult, and I think beyond that it serves as a psychological device for pigeonholing this type of vital research and pretending that it really is not important. I think a lot of people who should know better, a lot of journalists, a lot of political scientists and commentators, tend to use the phrase conspiracy theorist in order to dismiss anything that they're afraid to look at. I think many journalists and many political scientists use the phrase conspiracy theory or a conspiracy theorist, much the way Eastern European peasants used to hang garlic in the windows to ward off vampires. Essentially, it's an irrational, superstitious way of dismissing information out of hand that people would, for various reasons, would prefer not to look at. Examiner columnist John Dvorak has an interesting conspiracy theory. Is the Iraq invasion a fraud? Well, we'll find out. We'll take a look briefly at what he has to say. And I think, indeed, that column, or that cartoon, I should say, by Conrad in the L.A. Times has a lot to be said for it. We're going to take a look at how, apparently, even before the precipitous rise in oil prices as a result of the Middle East crisis, we're going to take a look at how the recession was already here and inflation was already on the way up. And we're going to ruminate about the timing of the invasion vis-a-vis U.S. economy. We're also going to take a look at the T-word, terrorism. There is much being said these days about how the U.S. move into the Middle East is going to precipitate terrorism by the various powers and interests in the Middle East. We've talked about terrorism a great deal. By the way, we're going to be coming back to the subject of terrorism next week. I've gotten some more fantastic work from Dave, our Italian translator, and we're going to be updating the Iran-Contra scandal, various counter-terror and terror aspects of the Iran-Contra scandal next week. We're going to be adding to the archives, and I think that people will find it more than worth their while. We're going to take a look at, among other things, predictions that the Iraqis will wage a terrorist war after the U.S. has moved into Saudi Arabia. We're going to take a look at the name Abu Abbas, a person we've looked at in the past in connection with, among others, Manzer al-Qassar, associate of terrorists, and also an associate in the Iran, in the Contra support effort of Oliver North. We're going to take a look at we're going to take a look, too, at some of the domestic implications of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, of the counter-terrorism, which the counter-terror measures which we may see instituted. And we're going to reflect about that against the background of the King Alfred Plan and other things, Rex 84. And we're going to take a look at some excellent research. As I said, I got another fine packet from Dave, our Italian translator, a first-rate researcher. And we're going to take a look at a fine article by Peter Dale Scott, characteristically excellent work by Professor Scott from the University of California at Berkeley. This was in a publication put out by Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and it talks about some of George Bush's machinations in the Iran-Contra scandal and how they were used to, among other things, shore up big oil and shore up the price of oil. Bush is an old oil man himself, and we'll be taking a look at George Bush pouring troubled waters on oil, or is it the other way around, in this Peter Dale Scott article. The recent disclosures concerning Roscoe White, whether or not they're accurate, have sparked a number of columns about the JFK assassination, ranging from, oh boy, more conspiracy theory, to some halfway serious observations concerning the assassination. We're going to take a look at a couple of ruminations by Examiner columnist Warren Hinkle in today's San Francisco Examiner Chronicle, and we're also going to take a look at how George Bush, when he was director of the CIA, helped to suppress former CIA director Richard Helms' perjury, well, actually, I couldn't call it perjury, his false testimony before the Warren Commission. Yet at least the fourth instance in which Bush's name has come up in connection with the investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy. That, in a nutshell, is what we have on tap for this evening. We're going to take another short musical break and then back with the main body of tonight's One Step Beyond show. Now, the first part of our show is going to be an extension of one of the things we spoke about last week. As I've said many times in the past, one of the major themes of this broadcast, of course, is this country's political assassinations of the 1960s and 70s, and their significance both at the time and their implications for today. It's by no means the only focus, but it is one of the major points of discussion over the years, and I feel is one of the foundations of any serious investigation, or must be one of the foundations, or part of the foundation of any serious investigation into American political reality. Now, last week we spoke about, in my opinion, a somewhat spurious story which has been floated recently concerning the assassination. There are, I suspect, elements of truth in it, but I suspect it's largely spurious. I'm not going to go into that this evening. It's contained in the tape of last week's broadcast, last week being August 12th of 1990, and that is available from Archives on Audio for those of you who might want to follow the discussion if you missed it. Now, one of the things we spoke about last week was the necessity of, as they say, getting off the grassy knoll. At the distance of 27 years from President Kennedy's assassination, I think it is both on the one hand a waste of time and also, in a way, kind of a further cover-up to be running around Dealey Plaza counting gunmen and cartridge cases and rifles and shots. We know that there were a number of gunmen, a number of rifles, and a number of shots. There was almost certainly a gunman on the grassy knoll or the railway overpass in front of President Kennedy. He fired the fatal shot. Lee Harvey Oswald was innocent. Beyond that, exactly how many gunmen there were, what their identities were, where they were located, what happened to them, will never be known for sure, nor at this point, frankly, does it make a hell of a lot of difference. Most of the facts concerning President Kennedy's assassination were known once the Warren Commission's testimony and exhibits were published. Those testimony and exhibits, Not the Warren Report itself, but the testimony and exhibits upon which the report was supposedly based, those totally disprove the Warren Report, as indicated in the Guns of November series, particularly Guns of November Part 2, dealing with the assassination of President Kennedy. The Warren Report itself is not only wrong, wrong it is, but all of its major tenets are physically impossible. They're not only wrong, but they could not possibly have happened. Basic laws of physics and mathematics were tampered with in order to come up with this preposterous thesis. Anyone who claims to be an objective observer and defends the Warren Report's, defends the Warren Report or the Warren Commission is simply lying in his or her teeth. No honest individual can possibly examine the Warren Report and the Warren Commission without damning both. It is simply, the official version of President Kennedy's assassination is so preposterous that I think that's one of the things which throws a lot of people off. It would never occur to them that something so totally ridiculous would come to be accepted as historical fact. That's one of the reasons why I think people should study these assassinations. When you see just how bad our government is willing to lie, and just how corrupt our journalistic and educational institutions are willing to become in order to perpetuate that lie, well, it is a sad but very valuable testimony as to the current state of this country. One of the important aspects of studying President Kennedy's assassination is to understand exactly who performed the assassination, why, and what the implications are for today. One of the major aspects of President Kennedy's assassination concerned the fact that it was basically a military coup. Among the reasons for President Kennedy's assassination were the fact that he was in the process of disengaging the United States from its long-standing involvement in Southeast Asia. Kennedy was literally moving to withdraw U.S. forces from Vietnam. I read Kennedy's order in NSA 263 from October 11th of 1963. I read that on the program last week, also NSA 273, dated November 26th of 63, actually drawn up on November 24th of 63. 2 days after Kennedy was killed, and read the key sections which reversed President Kennedy's pullout order. We also read a long essay by Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, who was at one point Air Force focal point officer, that is to say he coordinated all Air Force CIA operations that involved the use of air units. He coordinated those air units for the CIA. He later was in charge of special operations for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In that regard, not only was very much involved with the decision-making process vis-a-vis Vietnam, he helped draw up the report upon which NSA 263 was based. And Colonel Prouty's essay and his testimony is contained in last week's addendum to Guns of November Part 3, where I spoke about the Kennedy assassination of the Vietnam War. Now, I'm going to run through the various memoranda very quickly by way of review. There are four memoranda, four National Security Action Memoranda, which are critically relevant to the position of President Kennedy on Vietnam. The first is National Security Action Memorandum 111 from November 22nd of 1961, 2 years to the day before Kennedy was killed. And by the way, this information is carried in an essay by a former, the aforementioned Peter Dale Scott, professor at the University of California at Berkeley, in a book called The Assassinations, Dallas and Beyond, an anthology edited by Peter Dale Scott, Paul Hoke, and Russell Stettler. There is an essay called The Kennedy Assassination and the Vietnam War by Peter Dale Scott, which discusses these four National Security Action Memoranda. The first is NSA 111 from November 22, 1961, which commits the United States to helping the South Vietnamese and, more importantly, pointedly avoids using the language helping the South Vietnamese to win. Now, although at first glance this might appear to be a meaningless semantic distinction, in fact, as we discussed last week and discussed at greater length in the Guns of November Part 3, that particular distinction, the distinction between helping the South Vietnamese and helping the South Vietnamese win, in fact referred to two fundamentally different kinds of South Vietnamese commitments for the United States. Helping the South Vietnamese referred to a limited and open-ended commitment. Helping the South Vietnamese to win referred to the all-out military commitment that we wound up making. Kennedy pointedly avoided using the phrase helping the South Vietnamese to win. That language appeared for the first time in National Security Action Memorandum 273. NSA 249 from June 25th of 1963 suspended all covert operations against North Vietnam. NSA 273, as we looked at, provided for the reinstitution of those covert operations As we're going to look at this evening, those covert operations helped open the way for the tragic involvement of the United States in Vietnam by stimulating first the Gulf of Tonkin incident and later, as a direct result of that, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, under which U.S. forces were introduced into Vietnam in a major way. Then there was NSA 263, which we read on the air last week, which provided for an initial withdrawal of 1,000 U.S. troops by Christmas of 1963 and a phased withdrawal of all U.S. forces by the end of 1965. NSA 273, for the first time, used the language helping the South Vietnamese to win, thereby reversing NSA 111 of 11-22-61. It provided for the covert operations against North Vietnam, thereby reversing NSA 249 from 6-25-63, and it committed the United States to maintaining the magnitude and effectiveness of military and economic assistance at the levels of the Diem government. Now, No Dinh Diem was the president of South Vietnam. He was overthrown and assassinated in a coup about 20 days before Kennedy himself was killed. Diem actually wanted an increased U.S. involvement, so by committing the U.S. military and economic assistance to magnitudes and effectiveness commensurate with that during the Diem regime, they were, in effect and in practicality, canceling the troop withdrawal. It's somewhat oblique language, characteristically so, for diplomatic maneuvers, but it canceled President Kennedy's troop withdrawal and set the stage for the tragic escalation that followed. We're going to take a look briefly at certain aspects of the military's involvement in the assassination of President Kennedy. There are many other critical aspects to the assassination. As I said last week, as we looked at last week, one of the most important aspects of the assassination are the profound Nazi elements involved, both American and German neo-Nazis, some of the Project Paperclip scientists brought in by the United States at the end of World War II, and the Galen spy organization and the closely related anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, a key element of what today is known as the World Anti-Communist League, which figured prominently in, among other things, the Iran-Contra scandal. Now, the late Mae Brussel, the landmark researcher upon whose work my work is based in considerable measure, focused on these Nazi assassinations, these Nazi connections to the assassination, correctly so. And among the lessons to be learned by studying the events of Dallas of November 22nd, 63, is that basically on that day, the swastika rose over America. And if that sounds melodramatic, I refer you to The Guns of November, Part 4. Radio Free America shows 11, 12, 13, and 15. Also, the miscellaneous archive show that I replayed last week. Major General Edwin Walker, Lee Harvey Oswald, and the Fourth Reich. It's a long and very important connection. We haven't got time to go into it in detail this evening, but I strongly encourage listeners to this broadcast to pursue that information. Now, as I said, one of the important aspects of studying President Kennedy's assassination is to understand that it was basically a military coup. The national security establishment, that is to say the military and the intelligence services, were displeased with Kennedy for a number of different reasons. He refused to order U.S. forces in at the Bay of Pigs in support of the operation there. He refused to either bomb or invade Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. He was proposing joint space exploration with the Soviet Union in 1962. He had concluded the first substantive arms limitation treaty with the Soviet Union, the Atmospheric Test Ban Treaty, strongly opposed by the U.S. military. He had discussed breaking the CIA up into 1,000 pieces during his second administration. He was moving towards detente with the Soviet Union. He was disengaging the United States from Southeast Asia, and he was also moving to normalize relations with Fidel Castro of Cuba. We looked at that in Radio Free America number 12. All of these things caused Kennedy to run afoul of the military and the intelligence services, and they fixed his wagon and fixed it good on November 22nd, 1963. Well, this evening we're going to be looking at several aspects of our involvement in Vietnam and how we got there, the Gulf of Tonkin incident and covert operations directly related to it. One of the things that I thought might be worthwhile by way of transition from last week's material to this week's is to take a look at a portion of the trial transcript from Jim Garrison's trial in New Orleans. Now, New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison began investigating President Kennedy's assassination. Initially, he was after a guy named David Ferry. David Ferry died under strained circumstances, supposedly a suicide. But the suicide note was typed and did not have his signature. He had expressed fears that he was going to be killed. He actually died of a berry aneurysm at the base of the brain. How one can predict an aneurysm will burst is anybody's guess. It certainly looks as though David Ferry was murdered. Now, when the House Select Committee on Assassinations itself, badly compromised, came up with its final report, they recommended to the Department of Justice that they begin investigating David Ferry and the anti-Castro Cubans in New Orleans, or in New Orleans, I should say, thereby vindicating Jim Garrison to a considerable extent, although Garrison has never gotten the credit he deserved in that regard. It should be noted that he later, that is to say, Jim Garrison went after a fellow named Clay Shaw in New Orleans. Clay Shaw was acquitted, but although Clay Shaw, the jury, could not conclude that Clay Shaw was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, the fact of the matter is the jury did conclude that there had been a conspiracy to murder President Kennedy, and in fact, they actually heard testimony in the trial to that effect. Now, in a nutshell, the significance of what you're going to be hearing is as follows. The Warren Commission's thesis rests on a preposterous hypothesis, which has been known as the single bullet theory, or to critics and objective observers, the magic bullet theory. The Warren Commission had to prove that there were no more than three shots fired in the 6.5 seconds in Dallas, Texas, because if there were more than three shots, then there had to be more than one assassin. Not even the Warren Commission could pretend that Lee Harvey Oswald could have gotten four shots off in those 6.5 seconds. It's extremely doubtful that anyone could have gotten off three shots in the 6.5 seconds with that rifle with any degree of accuracy. Oswald certainly didn't do any shooting at all. There's no evidence whatsoever linking Lee Harvey Oswald with the rifle that he supposedly used. There's no evidence that Lee Harvey Oswald even fired a gun. Obviously, Oswald was killed before he could begin proving his innocence. It should also be known, too, that the Warren Report was written by Rudolph August Winokur, who was chief of the Pentagon's Historical Department. He was a German-born former agent for the Office of Strategic Services, America's World War II intelligence service. And it was he, the chief of the Pentagon's Historical Department, who wrote the Warren Report. Now, going back to the single bullet thesis, the Warren Commission had to prove that there were only three shots fired in Dealey Plaza on that particular day. Now, one shot missed the motorcade completely, struck a curb, and wounded a bystander named James Taig on the cheek. Taig spelled T-E-A-G-U-E, by the way. Another shot obviously shattered President Kennedy's head, which left the Warren Commission having to prove that one bullet, and one bullet only, caused all seven non-fatal wounds in President Kennedy and Governor Connally of Texas, who was riding in the same car. The fact of the matter is that the bullet which supposedly inflicted those seven wounds was undamaged, except for a small bit of material missing from the base of the bullet. That's like claiming that a Porsche 944 could go into a tree at 90 miles an hour or 70 miles an hour, and the only thing that would happen is the muffler would fall off. Well, obviously, that's preposterous. However, that has not stopped the Warren Commission's defenders over the years from defending its ludicrous conclusions. Beyond that, the sum total of the material that is in the seven non-fatal wounds supposedly made by the Magic Bullet, Commission Exhibit 399, the material in the wounds exceeds the weight of the material missing from the bullet, thereby positively proving what any intelligent person could simply see by looking at the exhibit, namely, or looking at the bullet, namely that the Warren Commission's thesis is ludicrous. Obviously, the whole is equal to the sum of its parts. The sum of the parts cannot be greater than the whole. That apparently didn't trouble the Warren Commission. They're maintaining that it must have been. The bullet also executed at least one sharp turn in midair without being acted upon by any external object, thereby acting in direct contravention of the law of inertia. Those are just some of the ludicrous aspects of the single bullet thesis. Now, one of the aspects of the single bullet thesis is that the physicians at Parkland Hospital, where Kennedy was taken shortly after he was shot, the physicians and nurses who observed the neck wound generally said, almost all of them agreed that it appeared to be an entrance wound, not the exit wound that the commission maintained it had to be. Now, in the section of the trial transcript you're about to hear, Colonel Fink, who performed the second autopsy on President Kennedy, Colonel Fink maintains that he was ordered by superior officers whose names he can't remember. I guess he got a case of the Oliver North disease. He maintains that he was ordered by superior officers not to dissect the neck wound. Now, this is actual unimpeached legal testimony before an American law court. It should be noted, as I said earlier, that the Warren Commission was a presidential fact-finding commission. It wasn't even part of the judicial branch of government. It was part of the executive branch of government. It has no legal status whatsoever. President Kennedy's assassination has only been in one court of law. That was Garrison's. And unimpeached trial, unimpeached testimony was given that you're about to hear that, in fact, the autopsy surgeon was ordered by unnamed superior officers not to dissect the neck wound. If anyone needed proof of a conspiracy, this is legal proof. This actually has the status of American law, which the Warren Commission doesn't. That, again, tragically, has not stopped people from supporting the Warren Commission's conclusion. But by way of taking a look at why I feel it's important to get away from the grassy knoll and to stop running around counting bullets and cartridge cases at the distance of 27 years, this is by way of looking at just exactly why a person doesn't need to do that. Last week we took a look at Edwin Walker and the fact that the supposed attempt by Lee Harvey Oswald on Edwin Walker's life, that particular alleged attempt was disclosed supposedly by Marina Oswald to the FBI. However, it should be noted that a neo-Nazi newspaper in Germany, the Nationalzeitung und Soldatenzeitung, actually printed that information, which came from General Edwin Walker, several days before the FBI supposedly first learned that from Marina Oswald. The same Major General Edwin Walker had been relieved of his commission by President Kennedy for teaching John Birch Society literature to his troops. Obviously, he was a bitter opponent of Kennedy's. Later, it should be noted that Warren Reynolds, one of two witnesses to identify Lee Harvey Oswald as the slayer of Dallas policeman J.D. Tippit, and again, there's no evidence whatsoever that Oswald killed J.D. Tippit. Warren Reynolds at first refused to identify Oswald as the shooter of Tippit, said that Oswald did not look like the man he saw. Warren Reynolds was then harassed. Then he was shot in the head. While he was recuperating, obviously he did not die, he got a visit from Major General Edwin Walker, at which point he changed his testimony, and upon reflection, he decided it was Lee Harvey Oswald. Simply on that basis, as well as so many of the others, one could begin a hard criminal investigation of President Kennedy's assassination by looking at the facts which are on the public record. No need to be running around playing games in Dealey Plaza. It should be noted, too, that any U.S. covert operation in President Kennedy's assassination was a covert operation is going to be surrounded by what are known as cutouts. That is to say, scenarios enough like the actual scenario to lead a willing observer astray and ultimately to lead a person down the primrose path and to throw them off the scent. There are many cutouts surrounding President Kennedy's assassination. I suspect that the recent disclosures or alleged disclosures concerning Roscoe or Rocky White are in fact just such a cutout. It would not surprise me if Roscoe White was involved with one aspect or another of President Kennedy's assassination, a minor aspect. Perhaps he was there to intimidate a witness or to remove a cartridge case or simply on the Dallas police force in case he was needed. But I doubt very seriously that the scenario is as presented. And again, the reason I think it is important to study our political assassinations is to understand the basic fact that the same kinds of covert operation and deadly force that our national security establishment has used abroad in countries like Iran, Guatemala, and others, that same kind of deadly force and covert operation has in fact been used in the United States on a regular basis since November 22, 1963. We don't just overthrow governments in play in the Third World, we overthrew our own government on that day, and that can be proven from the record. And it's important to study our assassinations in order to understand just exactly what kind of a government we have functioning today. And ultimately, we're going to proceed from the Garrison trial transcript, which a little bit of which you're going to hear right now. But we're going to move on to a discussion of the Gulf of Tonkin incident, and then we're going to jump to today. We're going to take a look at what's going on in the Middle East today by way of understanding the present in terms of the past, because of those who, frankly, take the events in the Middle East at face value, I think are being led dangerously astray, and an intelligent study of the past, I think, will yield an understanding of the present. As I like to say, if you don't study history, the world is a mystery. Read or bleed, learn or burn. We're now going to listen to a section from Radio Free America program number 12. I want listeners to pay close attention to this. It goes by rather quickly, but what you're going to hear is actual unimpeached trial transcription, unimpeached legal testimony in an American law court concerning the assassination of President Kennedy. As I say, you're going to hear the testimony or the transcript of the trial testimony by Colonel Fink, who performed the second autopsy on President Kennedy, and he's going to testify that his superior officers, unnamed generals or admirals, ordered him not to dissect the neck wound. They ordered him not to examine the neck wound in President Kennedy, the significance of which I spoke about earlier. And again, this is our way of taking a look at some of what's already on the public record. Now, we're talking about generals and admirals here, not mafiosi, not anti-Castro Cubans, although there were certainly both involved at the operational level in President Kennedy's assassination. But at the top of the assassination were none other than the military themselves, and it's important to understand the fact that the military overthrew the legitimate elected authority on November 22nd, 1963, because we have been dealing with the implications of that and the consequences of that ever since. It bears directly on the tragic chain of events which goes from November 22nd, 1963 to the events of August 1990 in the Middle East. We're now going to play a short section from Radio Free America, number 12. That's the third broadcast in the four-part Aryan Nation series. You're going to hear material, again, from Jim Garrison's investigation in New Orleans, from the actual trial. And that material, in turn, comes from the book Heritage of Stone. The first voice you will hear is that of my former co-host, Nip Tuck.
Anyway, going to read a small bit here from a book called A Heritage of Stone. The book is by Jim Garrison, who is, of course, the New Orleans district attorney, who is the only man who has really tried to put together a conspiracy case from a legal standpoint in the Kennedy assassination and tried to prosecute it through to its ultimate end, although he was stymied to an extent, although not the extent that is known, that is thought in popular mind. But anyway, the book is A Heritage of Stone, describing his travails by Jim Garrison, and the book was published in 1970 by G.P. Putnam Sons, New York. And what we're talking about here is the autopsy, and I will clarify any details after I read from this segment from Heritage of Stone. Immediately following the assassination, doctors at Parkland Hospital had, Parkland Hospital, by the way, is in Dallas. At Parkland Hospital had diagnosed the president's neck wound as an anterior wound received in the front of the neck. The long-concealed Zapruder film shows the president distinctly reacting as if the neck wound were received in the front. Yet the world had been told that there was only one assassin and that he was in the book depository to the president's rear. A probe of the neck wound by the pathologists in the Bethesda autopsy room would have revealed which way the truth lay. In retrospect, it is easy to see that this is precisely why no such probe was allowed. The neck wound, with the indications of a bullet entry but no exit, was to be the last real hurdle for the planners of the assassination. Afterward, the federal government would seize control of the investigation, despite its complete lack of legal authority, and that would be, in more ways than one, the end of the matter. It was 5 years after the assassination at the trial in New Orleans that it was learned that the neck wound had never been examined. Colonel Pierre Fink, F-I-N-C-K, the Army pathologist subpoenaed from Washington by the district attorney's office, had an unusually retentive memory for details. He simply could not recall, however, who ordered the pathologists not to look at the wound in the neck. Considering the historic occasion, and considering the implications of such a strange order, one would think he would never forget the man who issued this command. Fink was able to remember that the man was a general, and that he was not a doctor. But then his memory failed him. Fink was one of the pathologists who had conducted the autopsy. One of the other pathologists, Commander Humes, afterwards had burned his autopsy notes, contrary to medical custom. The government's pathologist was pressed on this point by the New Orleans District Attorney's Office. His questioning was conducted in behalf of the District Attorney's Office by Alvin Oser, O-S-E-R, the Executive Assistant District Attorney. Oser: well, at that particular time, doctor, why didn't you call the doctors at Parkland or attempt to ascertain what the doctors at Parkland may have done or may have seen while the president's body was still exposed to view on the autopsy table. Cutting in briefly to explain what the assistant district attorney is questioning him about is Fink was present at the autopsy at Bethesda. He's talking about what the doctors who tried to save Kennedy's life might have seen in Parkland in Dallas, and why several hours later, while they still have Kennedy's body on the autopsy table in Bethesda, they didn't call to compare notes with the Parkland doctors. Dr. Fink, I will remind you that I was not in charge of this autopsy, that I was called Ozer. You were a co-author of the report, though, weren't you, Doctor? Dr. Fink, wait. I was called as a consultant to look at these wounds. That doesn't mean I am running the show. Ozer, was Dr. Humes running the show? Dr. Fink, well, I heard Dr. Humes stating that. He said, who is in charge here? And I heard an army general, I don't remember his name, stating, I am. You must understand that in those circumstances, there were law enforcement officers, military people with various ranks, and you have to coordinate the operation according to directions. Ozer, but you were one of the three qualified pathologists standing at that autopsy table, were you not, Doctor? Dr. Fink, yes, I was. Ozer, was this Army General a qualified pathologist? Fink, no. Ozer, was he a doctor? Fink, no, not to my knowledge. Ozer, can you give me his name, Colonel? Dr. Fink, no, I can't. I don't remember. Ozer, do you happen to have the photographs and x-rays taken of President Kennedy's body at the time of the autopsy and shortly thereafter? Do you? Dr. Fink, I do not have x-rays or photographs of President Kennedy with me. Ozer, how many other military personnel were present at the autopsy, in the autopsy room? Fink, that autopsy room was quite crowded. It is a small autopsy room, and when you are called in circumstances like that to look at the wound of the President of the United States who is dead, you don't look around too much to ask people for their names and take notes on who they are and how many there are. I did not do so. The room was crowded with military and civilian personnel and federal agents, Secret Service agents, FBI agents, for part of the autopsy. But I cannot give you a precise breakdown as regards the attendance of the people in that autopsy room at Bethesda Naval Hospital. Ozer, Colonel, did you feel that you had to take orders from this Army General that was there directing the autopsy? Dr. Fink, no, because there were others. There were admirals. Ozer, there were admirals? Fink, oh yes, there were admirals, and when you were a lieutenant colonel in the Army, you just follow orders. And at the end of the autopsy, we were specifically told, as I recall it, it was by Admiral Kinney, the Surgeon General of the Navy. This is subject to verification. We were specifically told not to discuss this case. Now Ozer began to press the Army pathologist. Observe Dr. Fink's rapid backpedaling in this sensitive area, writes Jim Garrison. Ozer, do you have an occasion to dissect the track of that particular bullet in the victim as it lay in the autopsy table? Dr. Fink, I did not dissect the track in the neck. Ozer, why? Fink, this leads us into the disclosure of medical records. Ozer, Your Honor, I would like an answer from the Colonel, and I would ask the court to so direct. The court, that is correct. You should answer, Doctor. Fink, we didn't remove the organs at the neck. Ozer, why not, Doctor? Fink, for the reason that we were told to examine the head wounds and that the... Ozer, are you saying someone told you not to dissect the track? The court, let him finish his answer.